I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to this week's Sparks. Fast FM, a Muslim station in Bradford for Ramadan, and Fem FM in Bristol are two of the radio stations we profile. We've got Radio Caroline News and an Italian independent station in the spotlight. An interview with Sir Clive Sinclair. The BBC prepares for the renewal of its charter. Psst! Want to buy a slightly dated PC? Trade in surplus computers is now big business. And in Britain, the difficult task of portioning out the radio spectrum falls to the DTI. How effective are they as what they do? We give two points of view. A look at microwave drying. And has anyone ever tried to sell you a water filter? We examine how they work and do they live up to the claims made for them. Plus, more hi-fi lunacy in this week's Sparks on Radio Fax 3910 6205 and 12255.
Radio Spectrum Management, a review of a book published by DJ Withers in the IEEE. Managing the radio spectrum is an extremely complex multidisciplinary operation, For each of the internationally defined radio services, mobile, broadcasting, fixed, satellite, etc., there are international regulations and numerous technical recommendations and reports. For some services, such as sound and television broadcasting, there are regional agreements defining frequency plans, modification procedures, and coordination procedures. At the national level, there are a multitude of policies, procedures, and regulations. Even for someone immersed in this work, it can be difficult to identify the relevant documentation, and it is rarely possible to find a readable summary of the contents. For many, the whole subject is a complete mystery. Now, there can be no excuses. Radio spectrum management provides the most comprehensive description ever written of the process by which the radio spectrum is subdivided into broad allocations, detailed plans, and individual frequency assignments. Written by an expert in the field, this book provides an excellent guide to the radio regulations and CCIR texts, as well as containing a mine of technical information on radio systems, propagation, and spectrum management terminology. Each chapter ends with a comprehensive list of references. All radio services are covered, from broadcasting to radio astronomy, and mobile satellite to radio amateur. Thus, as well as providing detailed information for each service, the book presents a balance of the various interests which compete for the spectrum resource. The information on ITU matters is up to date as at the end of 1989. The latest edition of the International Radio Regulations is that of 1990, and the CCIR has since produced new and revised text in some areas. The resulting time lag is inevitable in a work of such complexity. However, the vast majority of the material is still valid, and the book will be of immense value to all involved in this fascinating subject. It will also help manufacturers, major users, and others who interface with the machinery of spectrum management. As a work of reference and a textbook for those new to the business of spectrum management, it should find application throughout the world. That's a review of a book called Radio Spectrum Management by DJ Withers. And it's published by Peter Peregrinus at the price of £59. However, you could try your local library. And the review was written by Michael Goddard, who for many years has been head of branch R1 at the DTI's Radio Communications Agency.
That was in the very establishmentarianism IEE journal. Here, in contrast, is a cutting column in Electronics Weekly, A Waste of Radio Spectrum. Who owns the radio spectrum? Everyone? No one? Governments? Important practical issues and billions of dollars ride on the answer to this question. Emerging mass market technologies for personal communicators, navigation aids, digital television, and a host of other products will generate enormous demand for the available radio space. American electronics giant Motorola is lobbying hard to clear the airwaves for its Iridium satellite-based personal communicator service. Without a slice of spectrum, Iridium will never get off the ground. Iridium and other potential radio spectrum users may or may not deserve access to the airwaves, but that's beside the point. At the moment, vital decisions over who can use the spectrum are taken by bureaucrats in governments and at international conferences, where national interests, the vested interests of existing spectrum users, and commercial rivalries lead to compromise, fudge, and delay. Certainly, governments need to allocate space for the military, for emergency services, and even for radio astronomers. But who says they are the judges of what is good for the consumer and for business, of how to divide the spectrum between commercial groups? Competing service providers know what the spectrum is worth to them, and by extension, what their service is worth to the public. Why not auction fixed-term leases on blocks of the spectrum off to the highest bidders? Leases that can be bought and sold to ensure this most efficient allocation of the scarce national resource. And while we're at it, why not make governments pay for the large chunks they carve out and reserve for themselves? That would focus budget-conscious ministerial minds wonderfully on whether they really need all that bandwidth and might even clear valuable space. One of the existing international telecoms bodies could be beefed up to supervise the process, and the billions raised can be dished out to needy causes or even as an annual dividend payout to every person on the planet, so we could all benefit from a scarce resource no one actually owns. Well, radical words there in Electronics Weekly. And looking to the Conservative government, that's exactly the sort of thing they've been saying that they've been doing with the NHS, isn't it? Making them allocate their money more accurately and focus their minds on where they can make savings. So surely that would have appealed to them. And on a slightly different facet of the radio spectrum, Trevor's been hard at work to try and clear the airwaves for Radiofax. He recently wrote a letter to the chief transmission engineer at Radio Moscow. I'm writing to report very high levels of spurious from your 6145 kHz transmission noted here on the 8th of March with World Service in English. The spurious spaced roughly every 32 kHz. The 6209 was about 20 dB below the main 6145 transmission, and its broadband hum made our 6205 completely inaudible. I wonder whether you can investigate the problem urgently and rectify the fault, please. Another problem we have is that a mixture product coming from your transmitter site when you have 6145 and 6175 operating together during the evenings. That's about minus 35 dB and around 6 dB below our signal here in the UK. Perhaps there's a chance of rearranging aerial arrays to reduce the level radiated. I hope you'll be able to help. So, just to show what we're doing as our bit to clean up the radio spectrum, on to a letter from Mary McPhillips, who lives in Smithborough, County Monaghan. It's over 6 months since I discovered Radiofax on 6205. I can't remember what the reception was like, as I didn't know how to log a station. What I also didn't know then was that Radiofax was a pirate. I only found out last month in Shortwave magazine. I have a strong liking for pirate radio stations, as they aren't under any strict rules, except the preferences of the listeners. 3 years ago we had a pirate boom in Ireland, but sadly the law came down on them. I mainly listen on 3910 on an old Nentone radio using an external program. I enjoy the programming, especially the DX program Sparks and the Classic Gold on Sundays. I hope this finds everyone well. Well, yes, we are, and long may you continue to grace our airwaves, and we'll try and do that as well. Your ardent fan, Mary McPhillips. And here's a letter from George Williams. Thank you for the copy of the Radio Listener's Guide for 1992. I will treasure it and I'm very grateful. He says I'm going to contact Labour's spokesman for the media if they win power. I think the Tory law on broadcasting is disastrous. It did no good to Caroline. Well, it was a Labour MP that brought in the original stuff in the 60s. However, these days it was the Conservatives who toughened up on the 1990 broadcasting bill. Have you read the book called Broadcasting from the High Seas by Paul Harris? I had a job to get it, but our local library kindly obtained it. It was a big book. Our local station will have on its board the widow of the former Liberal MP for Tiruro, David Penhaligon, who died in a car crash some time ago, sadly. That's George Williams. And here's, surely not a Christmas card, from Wadimar Melquist. I really enjoy your programmes on shortwave, 3910 and 6205. Signal strength here is very good, especially on 6205. I use an ICOM ICR71E receiver and 500 metres long wire aerial. Thank you for good music and entertaining programme. 500 metres of long wire, good grief. Fine information about the Queen and her radio problems in the castle. Now, thanks to Wadimar Melquist, who lives in Bertrask in Sweden, with his very, very long wire. And one more letter here. This is from Mike Smith from Leamington Spa in Warwickshire. Generally speaking, I enjoy the Sparks programme very much. I really must take issue with you on one point, however, and that is your general overall attitude to the UK independent radio sector. I know Radiofax is an unofficial or pirate operator, but your station provides a new and refreshingly different service. It was the 60s pirate stations that led the way to legalised UK commercial radio. It seems to me that whenever a feature on Sparks includes mention of independent radio stations, there has to be included some subtle and sarcastic criticism of our commercial radio network. It really makes my blood boil! The only operators to make any inroads into the state-controlled, dreadful, monopolistic and monolithic BBC has been unofficial and legal commercial radio stations, both past and present. Indeed, Radiofax wants to become legal, so that if that ever happened, you would start having to knock yourselves, as you would then be a legal independent radio station. I think not, somehow. So let's support these independent radio stations at the leading edge of British radio. I support Radiofax. I hope you'll take my views into account and don't knock ILR anymore. My very best wishes to all at Radiofax. That's a letter from Mike Smith. Well, thanks for the interesting letter and comments taken on board. And I wonder what everyone else thinks about that. Why don't you write in with your views? It's Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. Do you think we slag off independent radio too much? What's your view? If you'd like a reply, then please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG.
Can you tell me, dearest of James, is life really that much to blame? What seems like a million odd years, you've spun me around and dragged me down. Will you open your eyes? High, 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 you're always high on something. Do you ever try
FM calling Muslim fasters in The Guardian. Britain's first short-term radio station linked to a religious festival went on air for a month of music, interviews and readings from the Quran under the call sign Fast FM. Radio Ramadan, based in Bradford, broadcast throughout the annual Muslim fast. It started on the 5th of March and closed down on April the 6th. when the Eid celebrations marking the end of Ramadan finish. We've gone for one of the government's new restricted licences, and we've got to stop at the end of Eid, said Andy Sugden, a member of the non-profit-making group behind the station. But we're back again in autumn for the Bradford Festival, and perhaps we'll have a go at a Radio Lent next year. Two broadcasters from Radio Pennine, Yaqub Ali and Masood Sadiq, are comparing most of the output on 100.8 FM, covering West Yorkshire. Indian subcontinent music is interspersed with interviews in English and Urdu, and a bilingual serialisation of the Quran. That was by Martin Wainwright.
Here's David Jones writing for Daedalus in The Guardian. Hi-fi fanatics live in a strange sensual world. They may argue that one brand of tape is tauter, not quite as warm but better focused than another. A loudspeaker can show speed, coherence, dynamic life, but with a touch of latent aggression. Even a single resistor can be emotionally involving. To a scientist like Daedalus, this has to be nonsense, and thanks to the compact disc, he can prove it. A compact disc generates a stream of numbers, representing the position to be adopted by the loudspeaker cone of the sound system at successive intervals in time. Dreadco technicians are therefore fitting a loudspeaker with a fast-acting digital position indicator, whose stream of output numbers will show how the speaker is actually moving. The fidelity of the system can then be judged simply by playing a CD on it and feeding the CD instruction stream and the speaker response stream simultaneously into a computer. If the sound system is perfect, the two streams of numbers will be identical. If not, the computer will indicate what's wrong. The warmth, latent aggression, and emotional involvement in the equipment, or even the technicians, will be quite irrelevant. More cunning still, Daedalus can use this setup to give the ultimately perfect hi-fi. The trick is simply to feed the CD sound stream of numbers into the sound system with a slight delay. The computer, receiving the same stream undelayed, therefore knows what should be coming next. If the digital output from the speaker threatens to deviate from perfection, the computer can put it right. A few milliseconds delay will be enough. In this time, the computer can evaluate the current digit stream from the speaker and can make an informed guess as to what the next few numbers will be. Knowing what they should be, it can then calculate what correcting tweak signal must be fed into the amplifier to put things right, and can generate and send this signal. The computer's informed guesses, its model of the system, is derived by continuous evaluation of the success of its past corrections, and is steadily updated and optimized. It learns on the job, so to speak, and can rapidly perfect any sound system. Thus, one electronic box of tricks can raise any crummy sound system to perfection. Hi-fi fanaticism will vanish. All systems will be perfect, and all will sound perfectly alike. Well, in The Guardian that was. Well, in theory, that's of course possible and is the way that digital control currently works. However, you're limited by what you can do with your speakers, because if this box of tricks tells the speaker to move and it physically isn't going to, then you're not going to get your bitstream. But if you've got good enough speakers, then in theory, I suppose, that is possible.
Woman's Hour did a piece on the female special event radio station Femme FM in Bristol. Here's part of their report.
Sarah Davis went to talk to Trish Cavalli, one of the two women who got the scheme off the ground, and to some of the others who've become involved.
Your mother, your daughter, your sister, your lover, we're your friends. Femme FM. Your mother, your daughter, your sister, your lover, we're your friends.
We wanted to create a station that sounded different from any other station we'd heard, and create one that enabled a wide range of women's voices to be heard right across the age span, right across culture span as well. Initially, we gathered some women that we knew already, and we knew the skills that they had and they could contribute to the project. And when we were strong as a steering group, we held a series of public meetings all over Bristol, and 150 women came forward from those meetings wanting to volunteer to do things from making programs to becoming DJs to designing press and publicity, all the jobs that are needed to make a radio station. We had women coming forward saying, I'll just do it, I want to be involved, I want to support it, it just sounds really exciting.
Shall I start? Yep. It's 7 o'clock, a very good morning to you from Femme FM. We're broadcasting on 101. My name's Sangeeta Bhaskar, and I'll be here along with the Femme AM team right through till 9 o'clock, bringing you the latest travel, weather, and...
I work at a local radio station on an Asian programme. When I first heard about Femme, I thought, brilliant, great, this is what we've needed for ages, and I was just shocked that it hadn't been done before. A lot of other countries have got women's radio stations. Hopefully this will set precedence.
I run technical equipment on an amateur basis, mostly at science fiction conventions, so I'm running sound systems, lighting rigs, film projection. And I saw in a local newspaper a little bit about Femme FM and got dragged in on the technical side. I work full-time as a computer programmer, so I'm coming down here at 6 o'clock in the morning to set up the studio and do some of the run-throughs, and then I'm tearing out of the door, running off to the office, trying to do a day's work at the office, running back down here again in the evenings. It's definitely a bit hectic at the moment.
Women don't grow up in an environment where they're used to playing with machinery, so we've had to devise courses and allow women as much time as we possibly can without the resources we've got to actually just play with it, to realise it's just a machine, it's just slightly more complicated than the washing machine. And I think that's how we have to look at these things.
I was actually unemployed and I heard about Femme FM and I decided to get involved in a technical group because that was the thing I was mainly interested in. And then after a while I felt I wasn't really doing enough, I'd like to do more, and I had spare time, so I decided to take over the role as premises coordinator, which I've been doing for about 6 weeks now.
I think Femme is just making a point. It's saying, we can do it. We've got the skills, we've got the knowledge, we've got the know-how. And anyone can take it forward. Who knows, maybe for International Women's Day next year, there will be versions of Femme setting up all over the country.
That report from Sarah Davis.
A report now in Electronics Weekly. UK lorries wait for the amber light by Chris Bennett. British lorries could be the first vehicles to carry ultra-bright amber light-emitting diodes, LEDs, as replacements for conventional bulbs. Talks are taking place between Flexible Lamps, a British manufacturer of side lights for lorries, and Hewlett-Packard, which has just launched a range of bright yellow and amber LEDs. The new devices are made using Hewlett-Packard's aluminium indium gallium phosphide technology, which can produce LEDs in colours other than red, bright enough to be seen out of doors. Colours are in the 590 nanometers to 620 nanometer range. Brightnesses in amber can be as high as 8.4 candela with a narrow viewing angle. Up until now, red has been the only colour of LEDs that could be used out of doors. Red light LED systems are already being developed for cars in the United States and the UK. In Germany, BMW has introduced LED-based rear lights for its Cabriolet 7 series of cars. Thiel said Hewlett-Packard was now working on green LEDs using aluminium indium gallium phosphide technology and transferring LEDs onto transparent substrates, which could double the brightness. Well, I can't understand how they can find this economically viable for actually manufacturing the things, because surely bulbs are still going to be cheap. And the actual price of bulbs is passed on to the purchaser of the lorry or the car, because you and I have to keep changing the ruddy things, but it's not the manufacturer that pays for that. They have to pay for the full price of the LED, which is bound to be more expensive, I'd have thought, up front. So it's a brilliant idea, but I'm rather puzzled as to how it can manage to take off in practice. Well, we shall wait and see. Now, do you have any 813 valves in your junk box? We've now used up all our own stocks, so if you've got any 813s you don't want and you'd like to see them going to a good use, please wrap them up well and send them to us at the usual address. We'll immediately refund your postage costs, put them to good use, and be eternally grateful.
Like a cancer growth is removed by skill. Let it be revealed. A waterfall is madrigal. An inland sea is sea.
You're listening to Sparks, home of the hippie music, where you can hear media, scientific and technical news every Monday and Tuesday from Radio Facts on 6205, 3910 and 12255.
Now we'll risk everything falling to pieces by putting out the voice of Sir Clive Sinclair, the man who once bought unmarked transistors, marked them with coloured spots, and then sold them to us for articles which he'd published in the Constructor magazines. Subsequently, he went on to sell many innocent schoolboys the Sinclair IC10 integrated circuit power amplifier, which was basically a Plessy 2020, which he'd put a Sinclair label on top of, and then quoted rather more optimistic specifications than the manufacturer's datasheet. In the Radio 4 programme, On the Ropes, John Humphreys talks to people who have weathered major storms in their careers, and Sir Clive Sinclair is described as the computer genius who overestimated the appeal of his C5 car. Humphreys put it to him, there was a problem with his actual designs.
Your ideas didn't work. I didn't stand the test of commercial use, of use in the homes. I mean, there were problems with computers. There were delays with getting them delivered. Things went wrong. Inevitably, things went wrong. Was that a failure?
I don't think in terms of failure, really. I think if you're in the business of invention, you're in the business of pushing the frontiers all the time, and some things will work better than others. And if you don't have what you might call failures, i.e. things that don't succeed commercially, you haven't really been pushing the frontiers hard enough. You haven't been, you know, you're not at the front leading edge. How on earth, if you don't ever have products that don't succeed, do you learn where the limits are? It's like skiing down a mountain. If you never fall over, you're most unlikely to learn to ski very well.
So how do you react then when some people say, well, Clive Sinclair, brilliant man, the home computers and all that sort of, but then of course he did things that didn't work, you know, the little television sets and the other computers that didn't do the things they were meant to do and all that, and they got rather cross with you and some people tended to write you off.
Well, be that as it may, I mean, that's, I don't take it to heart. I mean, I, frankly, when I've had products that have succeeded, the praise has been excessive, and if the criticism is excessive as well, then that's as it should be, perhaps.
And you've not tended, perhaps, to use the public as a test bed, and you've not been...
Oh, well, there's that accusation of any body that brings out a new product, because there's never been, in the whole history of man's invention, a radical product that didn't have slight teething troubles, or sometimes with severe teething troubles.
And you've not been too enthusiastic, you've not sort of sat there, got the idea, rushed it in a direction and said, let's get it on the streets, you know, this is marvellous. And
I think in the early days we tended to get things out and have some teething troubles more than we would now, for two reasons. One, lack of experience on my part, because, you know, you do have to, you do learn as years go by, but much more importantly, the quality standards in manufacturing in this country, if you go back 20 years, were really not that good. If you bought electronic components 20 years ago here, the reliability of them was really not very good. And that's changed dramatically. So that today, we can turn, I'm glad to say, to people to make products that we develop that are absolutely marvellous at quality control. That wasn't so 20 years ago.
You're not just blaming somebody else for...
Yes, probably. partly blaming somebody else. If we had been perfect, we'd have made them ourselves. But we didn't have that know-how. And today we don't. I mean, I'm not an expert on manufacturing.
Later in the programme, the man who was driving a Rolls-Royce 20 years ago described the next product.
What we've done is to bring together a whole lot of new technologies. First of all, we've designed the bicycle itself to be much lighter than a conventional bike. Then we've taken a new battery technology that's come along very well recently, which is much lighter than the lead-acid battery. And we've developed a very compact motor with a company in Britain, based on new magnetic material that's been developed in Britain. So we've got a very, very compact motor. It only weighs a quarter of the weight of the one in C5, but it's actually more powerful. And we've got some very clever electronics which control all these, instead of having the sort of rather clumsy switching systems that we used before. Now, putting all this together gives us a bicycle that, even with the battery and the electronics and the motor, weighs no more than a racing bicycle. And yet it's got this long-range electric performance. I'm very excited about this because I think that's a marvellous first step in, for electric vehicles, and I hope and believe this will be the first large-volume electric vehicle, because it is truly a bicycle, and so has, you know, much more familiar form to it than the C5.
And when will that be in the shops?
We'll have that in the shops in the first half of this year.
Remember that date. Clive Sinclair there talking to John Humphreys in the On the Ropes programme.
Apparently they're going to be first available by mail order and will cost £499. Well, look out for those motors and batteries in the electronics surpluses catalogues in a couple of years' time. Or maybe the thing will be a success. Let's look on the bright side. Well, you might slag him off, but he introduced tens of thousands of engineers to computing about 10 years ago, including myself. And I was leafing through a Siliconix data book, which is normally a rather dull read and a very sort of technical read. And in that, from about 10 years ago, I found a Sinclair ZX81 program, of course, for the Timex Sinclair that was found over in America. And it was a basic listing, thousands of lines long, for doing simulation of programmable logic over 10 years ago using a ZX81. So you might slag him off, but he's done some useful things in his time. Sun hires Russian wizard for $100. Well, this is not the famous Sun, but the headline almost could be from it. In Electronics Times, written by Paul Swart, Sun Microsystems has hired a computer scientist who is considered to be the Russian counterpart of supercomputer wizard Seymour Cray. Boris Babayan has been hired to help redesign and improve the performance of the company's Spark line of microprocessors. The chief computer scientist of the former Soviet Union was responsible for the development of the Elbrus supercomputers, which the Soviets used to design their nuclear and other advanced weapon systems. Under the terms of the deal, Babayan and his team of about 50 software and hardware scientists will work full-time for Sun from their research laboratory in Moscow. The group will be part of Sun Labs, the Sun subsidiary responsible for the company's advanced product development. While Sun will supply Babayan's lab with all the Sun workstations and other computers it needs, the group will not be able to get Sun's most advanced workstations and servers, which are still restricted from export to the former Soviet Union. Babayan will be paid only $100 per month, and other engineers will receive even less. In the United States, engineers with Babayan's credentials can draw starting salaries of more than $100,000. Sun said Babayan did not want a Western-size income, which he said would create bitter feelings among members of his team and in the Russian computer science community.
A new advertisement appears in the classified small ads section of Private Eye magazine under the I Hear heading. Radio Caroline. Where is it? What happened? How can you help? 0836 404 576. For the full ding ding. Calls charged 36p a minute cheap rate, 48p a minute other times. RGS BCM 225 London WC1N 3XX. That advert's in Private Eye. Very curious. And now another short thing from The Guardian. The Radio Authority is publishing a consultative document laying out how it will go about re-advertising the licences for the 140 local independent radio services that are now scattered throughout Britain. Starting with North Sound Radio in Aberdeen this October, 55 licences will be re-advertised by the end of 1993, including all 21 so-called incremental stations, Jazz FM, Buzz FM, Spectrum, Melody, etc., with the rest coming up in 1994. The services, which include all those split frequencies that independent radio has introduced over the last few years, will not, thankfully, be awarded, like national commercial radio, to the highest bidder. That's from The Guardian.
And that Radio Caroline number again, 0836 404 576. And don't forget that you can hear Radio Caroline programmes on Radiofax every alternate Wednesday. A letter now from Heinz Dirk Vollmer, who's in Wilmerskirchen in German. He reports very good reception on 3910 and both 6205. And he listens on an FRG 8800, that's a Yaesu. Your programme is very interesting. Hope to hear more of your station, perhaps in German. Well, we've got no plans to do anything other than English, unfortunately. That's Heinz Dirk Vollmer. Thanks for your letter. And in Belgium, Christian de Breux is in Eghizé, to be exact. That's central Belgium. He's listening on 6205 and reports excellent audio. He's listening on old Grundig Satellite 2000 from 1971 with an indoor telescopic antenna. And he's part of the Broadcasting Band Survey, an independent amateur network. Thanks for that report. This week on Sparks, Fast FM, a Muslim station in Bradford for Ramadan, and Fem FM in Bristol. Radio Caroline News and an Italian independent station in the spotlight. An interview with Sir Clive Sinclair. The BBC prepares for the renewal of its charter. Psst, wanna buy a slightly dated PC? Trade in surplus computers is now big business. In Britain, the difficult task of portioning out the radio spectrum falls to the DTI. How effective are they? Microwave drying? Has anyone ever tried to sell you a water filter? We examine how they work and do they live up to the claims made for them. Plus, more hi-fi lunacy. That's in Sparks this week. Here's the record that was voted number one by Britain radio listeners. It's Hawkwind, Silver Machine.
ABC 777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
Two items about frequency use. First, new frequencies for radio microphones, long a contentious issue amongst broadcasters and theatre producers, where there haven't been enough legal frequencies, so it's been common practice to use unallocated ones. From this year, a new set of frequencies has been made available for UK use for radio mics in Channel 69. There are 5 ASP fixed frequencies for outdoor use, plus extra spectrum for theatre and fixed site use. Manufacturers can now choose their own indoor frequencies within the window based on a 25 kHz grid, but will require additional type approval tests prior to selling equipment on Channel 69. And that was from Lineup, the journal of the Institute of Broadcast Sound. Something about microwave heating. Dielectric or non-conductive heating has a wide range of applications in industry. There are 2 forms, radio frequency, RF, and microwave, whose relative merits have spawned a lively debate. All dielectric heating offers heat where it is wanted within the product without the thermal gradient found in conventional heat transfer, and selective heating, which in the case of drying is directly related to water content, so ensuring close control of moisture level. Dielectric techniques can be seen at work with food, plastics and rubber, wood, thermoplastics, textiles and glass fiber, paper and adhesives. Dielectric heating arises from the use of materials containing suitable molecules. These materials are placed in an electric field, alternating at microwave or radio frequencies. Heat is then generated through the body of the product by the rapid reversal of the polarization of the individual molecules. Materials with the most suitable molecules heat readily. Those with less suitable molecules heat hardly at all. Wet areas within a product can be selectively heated and dried, whereas dry areas will absorb little or no energy. As a result, ordinary water heats about 100 times more easily than common natural and synthetic fibres. Specific frequency wave bands are allocated for RF and microwave industrial heating. Microwave heating is on 896 MHz and 2450 MHz. And that piece was in PowerPoint, the newsletter for Seaboard's industrial customers.
Liquid refreshment. Water filters are gaining sales as people worry about the quality of their drinking water. But how do water filters work? By Ted Lister in The Guardian. There's been a growing public debate in recent years about the quality of drinking water in Britain. This had been linked in part with the privatisation of the water industry in 1989, which led to much discussion in the press about fears that the new private owners might not maintain standards. Public concern grew in the 1980s when the UK was taken to the European Court for alleged breaches of European Community standards. Other incidents have also made the headlines, such as that in Camelford in Cornwall, when water supplies were accidentally contaminated with high levels of aluminium sulphate in 1988. Such fears, together with a new marketing method, have led to a sharp increase in the use of bottled water and water filters. About 1 million bottles of mineral water are drunk each day, and UK sales of water filters are increasing. Tap water is never chemically pure. It contains some quantities of many substances. dissolved from the ground, some added in the treatment process, and some from the pipes through which the water flows. These impurities vary from place to place. Your local water supply company will send you a detailed analysis of the water it supplies. You have probably used filter paper making coffee. Filter papers have microscopic holes, rather than like a scaled-down colander, to strain out particles that are larger than the hair holes. In the case of water filters, the common jug filters are not filters at all. The particles which you want to remove, molecules and charged ions, are so small they would just pass easily through a filter paper. Jug filters contain a mixture of activated carbon granules and ion exchange resins which absorb impurities rather than strain them out. Activated carbon acts rather like a mass of tiny sponges, whose pores are about a million times smaller than those of a bath sponge. As the water flows past the carbon granules, ions and molecules become trapped in the pores and therefore removed from the water. Activated carbon is good at removing organic compounds, but inorganic compounds such as calcium and magnesium stay in. Eventually, the carbon will have absorbed as much as it can and will no longer work. There is even the danger that absorbed substances will be washed back into fresh water, worsening its quality. As there is no indication when this is happening, filter cartridges must be changed regularly. Activated carbon also removes chlorine, but in a different way, by acting as a chemical catalyst to change chlorine molecules into chloride ions. Ion exchange resins remove aluminium ions, nitrate ions, and calcium and magnesium ions, which cause hardness. Ions are electrically charged atoms or groups of atoms. Metal ions have positive charges, and non-metal ions have negative charges. Ion exchange resins consist of small plastic beads. The molecules of plastic have ions loosely bonded to their surfaces. These ions are either positively or negatively charged, depending on the type of resin. They can easily be replaced by different types of iron from various impurities in the water, hence the name ion exchange. Some types of resin, called cation exchange resins, have hydrogen ions, which they exchange for positively charged metal ions or cation ions. Anion exchange resins swap OH ions for, that's hydroxyl ions, for other negative ions, anions. The exchanges always involve the same overall charge, so that a calcium ion which has two positive charges must be exchanged for two H plus ions, and a triply charged aluminium ion for three H plus ions, and so on. Anion exchange resins work in the same sort of way. Once the water has passed on through both types of resin, the H and OH minus ions combine to form H2O, of course, water. Eventually, the resins in the filter will run out of ions to exchange and must be replaced. The same problem of washing back ions exists as with the activated carbon. Resins can be tailored to remove particular ions, so not all filters will remove all ions effectively. The one problem is that ion exchange resins and activated carbon form ideal media for the growth of bacteria. To prevent this, many jug filters contain finely divided silver. Silver compounds sterilize the filtered water as it stands in the jug. This effect has been known for many years. In the Far East, it's been common to drink water from silver vessels or to drop silver jewelry into drinking water. Do you need a water filter? Well, the simple answer to this question is almost certainly no in terms of health. Apart from rare incidents such as that of Get Camelford, the tap water in this country is safe to drink. Some people think that filtered water tastes better than tap water, probably because of the removal of chlorine, or makes a better cup of tea, because of the removal of hardness, but this is a matter of personal preference. That's Ted Lister, writing in The Guardian.
Next, Radio Dublin and Radio Caroline both get mentions on Media Network.
Now, a caller from the home front.
Hello, this is Juliet Herman. Secondly, Radio Dublin is back after an absence of a few weeks, and they put in a very We are a good signal here on 6910. That's 6910 for Radio Dublin.
Thank you to Julius Hermans, calling from Floten here in Holland. In fact, that transmission on 1386 kilohertz from Radio Ulla isn't new, but it certainly is thundering in here at the moment, late at night. And listening to Radio Dublin, I note that the name is now often announced as Radio Dublin International. Interesting to note that the Dutch Salvation Army magazine has a column listing programmes in which they're involved. They list a programme called Wonderful Words of Life, which they say you can hear every Tuesday on the pop music ship Radio Caroline, 558 kHz at 18 hours UTC. Well, I suppose it used to be on the air. There are rumours that the Radio Caroline ship might sail again, this time under a Liberian flag. But predicting what happens in the world of offshore radio is simply a fool's game.
Jonathan Marks there on Radio Netherlands.
And you can hear Radio Ala, a new station from Russia, on 1386 kHz on medium wave. That's after 9 o'clock UTC, and it's very strong in Europe. I was listening to it the other night. You don't need a frame aerial or anything. Interesting listening. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax. Mr. M. Cox writes to us from Wigan in Lancashire. I was listening in the twilight hours of this morning to your programme and thought I'd drop you a line. I'm a keen shortwave listener and was flicking around 3 MHz on upper sideband when I picked up your transmissions and switched to AM to see what it was. By the sound of the letter you read out from a listener in Canada, it seems your programme is popular. The area is quite built up, and having not a lot of space means not being able to construct a bigger long wire or better aerial system. Well, good luck with picking us up and other stations, Mr. M. Cox. David Underhill writes to us from Southport in Merseyside. I've enjoyed listening to your programme over recent months. I listen to your station on a SciShow SW5000, which is a rebatched Sangyan receiver with keypad frequency entry from 150 to 29999 kHz and FM broadcast band. Your signal was strong, with little fading and little interference, which is quite typical. My antenna is a G5RV multiband dipole, but you are also readable on the telescopic whip, which proved useful on Sunday when decorating. I particularly like your Sparks program. It would be useful if you could increase the number of programs you broadcast. Well, we will when we get transmitters in this country, because the whole thing will be a bit easier to organise. And why not write to your MP, making the case for independent shortwave broadcasts to rival the BBC? They do it on other bands, why not shortwave? My interests include broadcast band listening, RTTY, and WeFax reception and amateur radio. Good luck and regards. Thanks to David Underhill for that letter. James Brett lives in Tildesley in Manchester. I've been listening on and off since the weekend, having been told about Radio Fax by a shortwave listener. Your signal on 6205 seems better during the day, with 3910 better late at night. That's James Brett. Thanks for that letter. And in Merseyside, all these letters seem to be from the northwest. James Welsh lives in Birkenhead. I've found 6205 to be the best frequency in this area, as 3910 tends to be noisy. I can occasionally get 12255, even though it's not intended for this area. I heard you inviting people to send in lists of local pirate stations last week, and I enclose a list. So, around the northwest. Merseyside, 98.5 Concept Radio, mixed music and free radio news. 100 is Kiss FM, a continuous taped format. 100.8 Mersey FM playing chart music. 100.5 Laser FM playing oldies. 101 is Mersey Waves with 60s music. 101.5 CD FM with rock music. 101.5 also Radio Edna with mixed music. 102.2 is an unidentified station. And 104.9 TCR is reported to have been raided on the 23rd of February, along with Kiss FM and Mersey FM. This seems to be confirmed by the absence of any free radio activity for over a week. TCR plays reggae and dance and Asian music. And on medium wave, 1611 kilohertz. Rock radio was heard on the 1st of March. This is the first medium wave station heard locally since North Coast Radio. That's been widely heard all over the country at night with a low modulation depth. We heard it quite recently. Keep listening out on 1611 for things. And there's a lot of varied music on the pirate bands. Up in Merseyside, it all seems to be dance and reggae music down in London. No rock stations to be heard of in London or 60s music, which is quite unusual. So that's a report from James Walsh. And as the man said, we're always keen to have your reports of stations that can be heard in your area on any of the frequency bands. Send the report into Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. And I guarantee to read out any letter, your comments, and say hello to you on air. And if you'd like a reply, which includes a station card and an artist's impression of the transmission's site, along with technical information, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG.
Schools Radio at Risk in BBC Shake-Up, Georgina Henry, media editor of The Guardian. BBC Radio 5 may be scrapped in its present form and live radio ended for secondary schools under further recommendations of BBC task forces that have been examining the BBC's future role. Senior BBC executives are distilling the recommendations, the work of 15 task forces involving more than 100 BBC employees, to present a single document for discussion by the Board of Governors and Board of Management at the beginning of May. It will become the corporation's contribution to the debate about the renewal of its charter in 1996, which will start after the general election. The task forces say Radio 2 or Radio 5 should become a sports or music network. If Radio 2 is kept, it should narrow the gap with Radio 1 by trying to appeal to a younger audience. Secondary schools radio should be scrapped. The coverage of minority sport should be dropped, the task forces say, and multi-sport programmes like Sports Night and Grandstand should be reviewed. It is unclear how many of the task force's recommendations will survive through to the final BBC document. Some proposals that have been leaked, including a recommendation to end the £11 million spent on the BBC's orchestras and a plan to limit the power of the Board of Governors, have been rejected by Sir Michael Checkland, the Director General. Sir Michael has also said he does not believe that a 24-hour radio news channel, another recommendation, can be started until the middle 1990s. He said the BBC needed to be sure it would have an audience. A BBC executive said that it was impossible to put through all the recommendations because several were contradictory. They also had to be costed. We then have to consider what it is post-1996 that other broadcasters will be offering. We want to make sure the BBC is not simply planning to do what everyone else is doing. John Burt, the Director General Designate, has not yet disclosed his thoughts on the future. Mr. Burt, now Deputy Director General, does not officially take over from Sir Michael until next March, but will play a key part in presenting the BBC's arguments to the government. If the Conservatives win the general election, Kenneth Baker, the Home Secretary, has promised a wide-ranging public debate in which every radical option for the BBC will be up for discussion. The question of how to fund the BBC, whether parts of it should take advertising or be subscription-based, and whether it is too big and bureaucratic, are bound to be raised. Mr. Baker has been dismissive of the BBC's attempts to prepare itself for the charter debate. Recently, he said that Kafka would have been at home with the task forces. Labour is committed to the licence fee, but will want a debate about the BBC's role. The task forces have made a robust case for the licence fee and argue that advertising or subscription would jeopardise the BBC's quality of programmes. There is criticism, however, of BBC drama and light entertainment said to be tired. Although there is strong support for the BBC to maintain its popular appeal, it is urged to concentrate on what it does best, rather than match the competition. Georgina Henry in The Guardian.
Could own and race from the
to buy a slightly dated PC? Howard Stroman's products have fallen off the back of a failed marketing campaign. Paul Fisher talks business with the dealmaker. He lowers his voice and says he can't afford to mention the names of any of the businesses that PST sells to, or list the brand names of whatever he's selling. Do you think I'm an idiot? Otherwise, reticence isn't Howard Stroman's personal style. He's wearing a Rolex watch that could crush a cat. And I knew I'd arrived at his part of an anonymous trading estate near Heathrow Airport when I parked next to a lobster-coloured Rolls-Royce Corniche. Registration PST1. Stroman is PST's number one man, and his stock in trade is anonymous computer equipment. It's usually IBM PC compatible, though never IBM, is always unused but slightly dated, and is bought from the manufacturer. It's cheap but strictly legal, because everything PST buys has fallen off the back of a failed marketing campaign. Stroman's corporate videos reassure manufacturers that he pays on the nail, collects stock immediately, and won't sell to anybody who will retail in their markets. Probably Europe's largest buyers of surplus and discount stock is how Stroman describes his business. And to explain its details, he's got a nice line in euphemisms. Debadging means throwing the labels away so that the cock-up of a company selling off its penultimate model goes undetected. Dissipating means steering clear of the multinationals' target markets by selling smallish quantities to countries, mainly East European, which they can't be bothered with. And bundling is uniting out-of-fashion software with hardware which is past its sell-by date. Stroman is a global undertaker who profits from the way technological change and competition force computer prices down. We specialise in reaching parts of the world other people can't, he says, and talks of the 2,000 Japanese non-IBM PC compatibles originally offered him for £500,000. A year later, he bought them for £60,000, debadged them, bundled them with a printer and an early version of WordStar, and dissipated them in the Middle East as cheap word processors. It's good to hear a computer merchant say cheap instead of flexible or cost-effective. Stroman rejects the biggest lie of the computer business, that most customers are prepared to pay dearly for quality. He knows they're often seduced by the overpowerful and the new, and what makes him unusual is that it pays him to say so. Everything will sell if the price is right, is his general rule, and the particular one for the PC business is that price is always the issue. Names emerge, 34 from Amstrad and BT to Toshiba and Zenith, are listed on a brochure as having used our services, presumably by offloading products they couldn't or wouldn't sell to their dealers. Last December, a PST press release intended for British dealers announced a £5 million purchase, including 45,000 wide carriage printers with Cyrillic and ASCII character sets from a leading Japanese manufacturer. In January, an advert in the International Herald Tribune revealed PST had thousands of Oki Microline 183 printers for sale. They were an order from Russia, where payment was never made, Stroman explains. I had the ASCII character set installed. Originally, they retailed at £300, and I'll sell them in small quantities for £89 or £70 for more than 1,000. Stroman won't sell direct to the public or name his dealer customers, so this news is not much use to the average buyer of a single printer. His advice to normal buyers is the blandest consumerism, though none the worse for that. First, you've got to know what you want. When it comes to buying a computer, he says, a lot of people have got no idea and are often sold a Ferrari when a Ford would be satisfactory. Next, ask yourself if you need the latest technology. His 10-year-old stock control computer underlines that he doesn't think he needs it. And pointing to a debadged micro, he makes the point that these machines are much of a muchness. Always haggle, but if it's over a new and branded product, remember that dealers have limited margins. And comb the ads in thick magazines like Personal Computer World. My customers are evident by their type of ads, he says. Then he summarizes the merchant's advantage. You've got to have contacts, he says, and you've got to have the balls to do deals. PST, short for Photographic Secondhand Trading, has been doing deals since 1974, when cameras were the fashionable gadgets. In 1983, Stroman was called on by his contacts at WH Smith, which had overstocked 2000 Advance 86Bs, a PC compatible, from Ferranti. Later, he paid Alan Sugar £3 million for the 160,000 Spectrums and QLs that Amstrad had bought, along with the Sinclair name. Like many others in the computer business, PST increased its concentration on PC compatibles, and then, like few others, Stroman sold his company to Cannon Street Investments and netted himself over £20 million. So no, I don't think he's an idiot. In order to arrange swift payments in hotel rooms, Stroman carries portable computers, modems and faxes around. He shows me his debadged notebook computer. A recommended retail price of £1,600, it now sells at under £800. But seems more interested in his new Hewlett-Packard palm top computer, which includes Lotus 123 and can store thousands of phone numbers. I'm a gadget man. I'm interested in the new. Nobody who drives a lurid roller can have an overriding belief in utility at the cheapest price. Knowing now that everything sells, if the price is right, I make discreet inquiries. I bought it new when there was a premium on those models. Believe me, cars are bad news at the moment. It's computers we should be buying. The Hidden World of the Computer Trade by Paul Fisher in The Guardian. In Radio World, Rete 105 succeeds with technology by Dario Calabresi in Milan. Italy was the first European country where the government's broadcasting monopoly was broken more than 15 years ago. Today, Rete 105, headquartered in Milan, from where it distributes programming via radio links to 20 member stations, is the country's largest privately owned radio network. Private commercial stations, however, were unregulated until a media law passed last year. The regulations, however, are not implemented fully because of the complexity of technical issues, particularly concerning frequency allocations. Rete 105 applied for licenses under the new law, and Eduardo Hazan, president and owner, is confident that they will be approved. Hazan also manages the Italian language service of Radio Monte Carlo, the official broadcaster of nearby Monaco. Developed by a company of 10 friends, Rete 105 began in February 1976 as a local Milan station. There was a monopoly law at the time. Strictly speaking, we were pirates, Hazan says. The main studio in Milan, Studio 1, is used for live broadcasts and recordings. Studio 2, filled with equipment of various models and makes, is used for recording only. In Studio 2, national commercials are inserted onto tape. Local commercials are recorded with cue codes on the tape through a CPAR automatic system to alert operators at the local stations. Other Studio 2 activities include listening to music and developing the programming using the Selector system made by Radio Computing Services of the United States. In addition to Studios 1 and 2, there is a relatively large room used to broadcast live programs with an audience. Finally, in addition to two OB vehicles used for pop concerts and other remotes, there is an off-site studio located in a large and famous downtown music store, Ricordi. Here, Rete 105 broadcasts some live programs, where, for example, a pop star will sign copies of a new record. Radio Monte Carlo goes on the air live from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. and from 9 p.m. to 12 p.m., while from midnight to 6 a.m. it broadcasts recorded music. Throughout the rest of the day, programmes are originated from the main studio in Monte Carlo, getting to Milan through two radio links. One is the same 14 GHz link used by Tele Monte Carlo, the Principality's TV station. The radio operation uses one of the audio subcarriers of this link, manufactured by Thompson and owned by Tele Monte Carlo. The other one, used as a backup, is a 900 MHz FM link made in Italy by Elka. During live broadcasts of Rete 105, one or more disc jockeys are at the console and an engineer is in the control room with the DJ, sometimes breaking in through a fading control. Often the engineer separates local and national commercials. As for the other network stations, they are not normally equipped with elaborate studios because production is carried out in Milan. Processing is centralized throughout the network using the Optimod FM processor. Major maintenance and installations are provided by a 10-member team called the Radio Engineering Company, based in Milan and owned by Rete 105. Routine maintenance sometimes is conducted by local contractors. The chief engineer of the engineering company, Marco Cavestro, said the network used a lot of Elpro transmission equipment in the past, but now that the company has closed, equipment comes from CL, Elenos and Syra, all Italian companies. The final stage on this roof is made by IRTE, and all the 900 MHz links by Elka. Both are also domestic manufacturers. In general, we try as much as possible to have more than one supplier, not to depend on just one, Cavestro says. Rete 105 uses some foreign equipment, including Rohde & Schwarz stereo and RDS encoders, as well as overseas manufactured studio equipment. Cavestro said the large equipment purchases, such as transmission equipment, are budgeted through the network, but with less expensive studio equipment there are no strict limits. The 1991 equipment budget for Rete 105 was 3 billion lira, slightly more than $2 million. Rete 105 relies on a regular maintenance schedule to avoid technical problems. If there is a sudden malfunction, the same engineer working in the control room will try to solve the immediate problem in the best possible way, for example, by replacing the defective machine with one of the backup devices that are always kept available. The defective machine itself will then be fixed later by other people in the engineering company or sent to the manufacturer for repair. Hazan is proud of his unique engineering department. If there is a lightning strike or any other technical emergency anywhere in Italy, our engineers will be there within 24 hours. Dario Calabresi in Radio World.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. Hello to Gert Jan van der Berg in Hoog Zwaluwe in Holland. He says, I used an FRG7700 receiver with an L antenna, and he's listening on 3910. And hello to Goran Lundstedt in Lund in Sweden, who listens on 3910 on a Sangian ATS 808. He's a journalist.